This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. As we continue our coverage from the People's Summit in Chicago last weekend, we turn next to Dante Barry. He's the executive director of the group Million Hoodies for Justice. It's a human rights organization aimed at addressing racism and systemic violence against communities of color. Million Hoodies for Justice was founded in the wake of Trayvon Martin's killing in Florida, and it was among many organizations present at the People's Summit in Chicago in the hopes of building a new progressive political movement. I sat down with Dante Barry to talk about it.
I am here at the People's Summit in Chicago with Dante Barry. He is the executive director of Million Hoodies for Justice. Welcome to the program, Dante.
Hi, how are you doing? So good to be here.
Good to be here as well. Thanks for joining us. What brings you to the People's Summit? This seems to be a gathering place primarily for people who are looking to effect electoral change, a lot of Bernie supporters. What brings you here?
I'm here because we need a movement of movements, right? And I think whether it was this last election or the conditions that has largely faced the black and brown communities, we need to really double down on our strategies and tactics moving forward. And I think what we're seeing with the election of 45 is that right now we're seeing so much new energy to bring in new people in order to shift the conditions that impact our lives. So I'm here really to kind of think about what are the strategies and how can we bring that back to our work as a black-led organization that is organizing young black and brown people. When oftentimes when it comes to electoral politics, we our communities don't necessarily feel excited about about particular candidates or about the infrastructure or the system. And so how do we actually think about new ways of innovating around electoral politics?
Does your organization engage with local races? Because that is where a lot of the energy seems to be these days. We sort of understood that the White House is unavailable for a while. And so a lot of energy is going into some local races with some pretty good results.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think based upon our motto at Million Hoodies, we believe that local is everything, right? All politics is local. If you aren't able to influence the way that your city council is moving and making decisions about the police in your community, then like it's a big problem, right? In the same way where if we're not seeing young people taking ownership around like school board presidents, right? And like the ways in which our schools are being decided and our decisions that are impact our lives, right? And so I think for our folks, we really see that local politics is really everything. It's where we can make the most sort of change. It's actually where we can see the most form of impact, right? And I think right now communities want to see immediate impact, immediate change in their lives when we know that we need people to be feeling inspired and connected to the work that they're already doing.
Are there examples of races in recent months or even the past year that Million Hoodies had an impact on that you can point to and say, we helped to do that and that's having an important effect in our communities?
Not yet. Right now, we absorbed a lot of newer people into the movement, right? We absorbed a lot of younger, newer organizers.
Just the past year?
Over the past couple of years. Especially,
why is that?
Especially in light of the crises around the killings of black people by police. We have tons of people that want to take action. They've gone to a march and a protest and like, we want more. We want to do something more like that's sustainable. And we've been absorbing more folks as well over the last year along on the same time. And so right now we're really just thinking about how do we create new forms of leadership that we can emulate and build power around and hopefully create the type of leadership that creates the opportunities for our members to possibly run for office one day, right? And so I think we're in a situation that we really need to redefine what is the type of leadership that we need in this moment that can be unapologetic, that can be bold, that can also push forward transformative ideas and to bring communities together at the same time.
So one of your main headquarters, I understand, is in New York. What has the change in leadership at the city level in New York meant with the election of Bill de Blasio, you know, we have seen some pretty transformative things from the outside looking in, those of us outside of New York. Have you felt those changes palpably on the streets of New York, particularly for black and brown communities?
I think the election of Bill de Blasio is an interesting one. I think that in many aspects he has not fulfilled his promises, and we've seen in response to that where a couple years ago the New York City Council of Police proposed 1,000 new cops to be added to the city's budget, which would have totaled about over $1 million that could be added towards that could be actually used towards building a social safety net for black and brown communities to keep ourselves safe, right? But Bill de Blasio went on a platform of police reform and economic populist, and actually like reneged on a lot of his promises. And so we had our communities actually challenge that and say, no, we don't want more police in our community. We want a social safety net. And I think right now it's an interesting moment when we head towards this next mayoral election, and whether or not he will continue to kind of push forward this very strong support for the police versus really pushing forward an agenda that is about police reform and being about community safety.
So then ultimately, would you say, looking back on Bill de Blasio, that he has been yet another one of these progressives who, when they get into power, end up with business as usual, because it does take a lot of work to change momentum of things that are well established, particularly when it comes to the police, because of course police egos are quite fragile. All you have to do is look in the wrong direction at some, you know, at a cop, and the entire police union will have the force arrayed against you and turn their backs on you, and that puts a lot of pressure on politicians.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we cannot underestimate the influence of the police union and the forces that really support police in that way. And I think in large part, like, Bill de Blasio is very much afraid, right?
They put him on notice during his inauguration.
Exactly, which is also why he should not feel upset because of that, right? And I think it's oftentimes they don't necessarily have the power as much as the communities that really want real police reform. But yeah, I think right now this is a really interesting moment for us to be contending power and to be building an agenda, pushing forward an agenda that is really transformative. And I think at the same time, when we talk about this idea of sanctuary, right? Bill de Blasio has said that New York City is a sanctuary city, but at the same time, is still supportive of broken windows policing that actually continues to criminalize black and brown immigrants and black and brown communities at the same time. And so we can't be a sanctuary city when we continue to have zero tolerance policing that impacts our communities at the same time.
We have the exact or similar dynamic in Los Angeles, the other big city in the U.S., where we've heard our mayor and police chief talk about sanctuary for immigrants without addressing the out-of-control Los Angeles Police Department, which is the department that has, of course, been guilty of the most police killings of any single police department in the country. So it is interesting to see these sort of double standards. Now, I want to talk to you about activism. You talked about how in the last couple of years you've had an infusion of young blood. As someone who's been doing this longer, how do you talk to young people who are interested in joining the movement? What sort of preparation or training or experience do you feel people, or how do you direct young folks into the movement in a way that makes best use of their activism and their energy and doesn't lead to burnout or disappointment?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm just so excited by the tons of people that are like now finding new light and energy and feeling activated in this moment. I think for the most part, the first thing that I truly believe in is not this idea of self-care, but community care, right? If we're really about building communities and strong communities, that we need to be able to learn how to take care of each other, right? And that activism and organizing, yes, it's all very political and it's good to talk about the things that are impacting our lives, but it's also about being in deep relationship with other people that you may not have previously have an experience with, right? And being able to share and exchange in ideas in a meaningful, transformative way, and being able to hang out with those folks, like hang out and go to a party or hang out and go to a people summit, right? And we have some of our newer activists and newer organizers here today building relationships and being able to get new experiences by being at this convening. But I think also part of it is having some patience, right? That like organizing and activism, when you grow in your skill set, when you go in analysis, is a process. You're not gonna have the perfect set of analysis. You're not gonna have the perfect set of ideas around strategy. But it's something that you cultivate over time, and you do that by going to different trainings. You do that by going to different convenings. You do that by skill sharing and peer learning. And I think really is that in this moment, we need to be able to connect people to real political homes that can cultivate new skills, that can cultivate a real community for folks, because that's the other thing that folks want. We want young people, and particularly want community, and we're not finding community in the similar ways that the Kiwanis Club was kind of created years ago, right?
So we churches
and so forth, right? And so we need to be able to develop new forms of political engagement and civic engagement.
So one of the problems that that the left has often faced, maybe it's becoming slightly less of a problem now, but one that is we've often faced, and from myself attending many of such gatherings over the years, we notice that some of these national gatherings end up being very white-dominated spaces. And you see a little bit of that here as well at the People Summit. The attendees are a little bit more diverse, but I still feel like we don't have enough representation of black and brown folks. On the speakers' side and the panels, there is also progress, but I'm wondering whether you feel like there's been enough progress. So is that a big challenge for the left as a whole in the United States? Because the people on the front lines of the impact of Trump's America are black and brown poor folks.
Absolutely. I think one of the answers to that question is, to what end, right? To what end are we measuring? How much are we progressing? And to that extent, does that also mean that we need to continue to create our own spaces in order to make sure that our voices are being represented and heard and also have power behind, right?
There are sort of gatherings like Race Forward.
Exactly, like Race Forward. We're getting ready for our own membership convening next month, where we're bringing together about 75, 100 million hoodies members from around the country. And so like we definitely believe in being able to build autonomous spaces so that we can like build our own agenda. But it's also equally important for us to be in some of these spaces so that those folks that don't necessarily hear our voices or our perspectives or our stories can also be agitated a little bit to do a little bit more, right? And I think what we heard last night was a bit of some agitation from folks, right?
Yeah, tell us about that.
About like when we talk about building intersectional movements and building the movements that have been so transformative, that have been mostly led by black and brown communities, women of color, queer communities, that we really need to be centering and following the leadership of those that are most impacted, because that's when the most transformative opportunities emerge. In order for us to agitate in these spaces, we're never going to see real change. And change happens when we are able to agitate and just do some disruptions.
Do you feel that in order to, and this has been a controversial issue that we've seen popping up on social media, that sometimes in order for there to be created spaces for black and brown people, that sometimes we do need our white allies to step back. That might, the greatest action of solidarity they might be able to take is to literally step back and insist that a non-white person take their place. Is that too controversial?
I don't think that's too controversial. I think it's about power, sharing power, right? I think of power as organized resources, organized people, and organized money, right? And so for those folks that have already that accumulated that set of power, it's about how do we share those resources to other communities that might not have the same level of access or reach to that power. And so I think it's not too controversial. And I think that if we're really about building a transformative movement, we need to do some shifting in our strategies and tactics in order to do that. And we need to have those hard conversations about white supremacy, patriarchy, and so forth in order to build the movement that we need.
do you make of, just recently I spoke with Joe Dinkin of the Working Families Party, and one of the things that he told me was that his party strongly endorsed the candidacy of Chukwe Antar Lumumba for the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Is that a type of solidarity that you see that can be very effective to see non-white leaders, black and brown leaders, who present these powerful progressive platforms like Lumumba did, and promote them, push them, and help them get elected?
That's a tough question. I think, and it presents itself with a lot of nuance, right? And I think yes, ultimately it's great that like folks are ready to support a more radical leftist type of organizer and leader like Lumumba, a black radical who grew up in Jackson, Mississippi through an organization called the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement that is implementing the Jackson Kush Plan. I think that's phenomenal. But we also have to put some scrutiny as for those traditional organizations that have not necessarily demonstrated that level of solidarity before, and whether or not it's an attempt of a co-option and manipulation, or if it's an attempt for building real political power, right? And I think that's a worthy question, right? And we need to be able to like also support those folks that have been able to hold that politic for generations.
So you worry that supporting some of the support to Lumumba might have been almost co-optation?
A little bit, right? I think maybe at some point Lumumba might not have been the perfect candidate for groups of people to support, because he might have been too radical or might have been too X or too black, right? And so at what point did that transition happen where it made it viable for them to support a candidate like Lumumba?
It's not the first time he ran, right?
I don't think so. But at the same time, right? He is his father was a mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. It comes from a political family with a very particular political analysis and politic, and comes from an organization, a black leftist organization, that has been doing work for the last 25 years in communities across the country.
So what sort of solidarity and connections does Million Hoodies for Justice do with other communities? For example, are you forging ties with groups that do activism around the rights of undocumented immigrants, Muslims, you know, those other groups that are demonized, criminalized, targeted alongside black Americans, particularly in Trump's America?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we're doing two things. One, we are partnering with the Dream Defenders, United We Dream, the Women's March, I'm an Immigrant, and a couple of other organizations to host this day of the National Day of Dinners. This is June 25th. We're asking communities across the country to hold a dinner, right? And to bring a item of significance to that dinner, to like really be able to engage in conversation across difference. Because when folks are at dinner, right, sometimes the things that are not often or taboo to be discussed are religious issues and are political issues. And so we want to be able to have those conversations in a new way rather than having pushing people to an action or a protest, in order to engage a new set of people who want to be politically engaged and want to be politically active. The second thing that we're doing, we're actually a part of this larger campaign called Freedom Cities, right? This idea of expanded sanctuary. We know that black people are not feeling safe. We know that women are not feeling safe, that queer people are not feeling safe, immigrants are not feeling safe. All of these different types of communities are not feeling safe. And so what does it look like to build intersectional infrastructure that keeps all of our communities safe and say, no, we're going to be building freedom for all of our communities, and that we're not going to make negotiations, because oftentimes when we talk about safety, one community gets thrown under the bus over another community, and we don't want to make that happen. We don't want to make that tension happen. Just like Bill de Blasio talking about sanctuary cities, right? Sometimes black communities get thrown under the bus over other communities in that light. And so we want to be able to build real solidarity and real infrastructure that keeps our community safe.
You've got a website for Million Hoodies and where people can find out about the Freedom Cities and the dinners that you mentioned.
Absolutely. So if folks are interested in learning more about Million Hoodies, they can visit our website at millionhoodies.net. Follow us on Twitter at Million Hoodies, or go visit the two upcoming projects that we have at dayofdinners.org and freedomcities.org to learn more how to plug into those campaigns.
Post links to that from our website. Dante, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Dante Barry, the executive director of Million Hoodies for Justice. We spoke at the People's Summit in Chicago, Illinois this past weekend. You can find out more about his organization at millionhoodies.net. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.